Okay, well, okay, talk to everyone. My apologies if you don't yet have a source sheet, but you will have one in a few minutes. There's some more coming downstairs, and we'll make a quick pause when they arrive, and we'll get into it. As promised, the last topic of the three dealing with marriage issues, and this one actually deals with a very critical marriage issue, which is the prenuptial agreement, of which a lot has been said over the last few years. And I'd like to lead into a discussion of the prenup and why some people feel that it's a very important solution to the Aguna crisis, and why other people feel that it's not helpful in different ways, and try and understand that fully. And if that's not helpful as a means of dealing with some real issues with the Aguna problem, and what else could be helpful? What has been tried? And I'd like to go through a whole range, maybe not all of them today, this is in two parts. But today we'll set the scene, and next week we'll finish it off. But I'd like to talk about all, not all, but many of the issues which have been proposed, such as the New York State GET laws and other equivalents that have been passed in Canada, in England, etc. Solutions proposed in the past with the Hafka'at Kiddushin. Can the Kiddushin be unwound retroactively so that actually the couple were never married? What needs to go into doing that? What about the issue of Kiddushin al-Tanai? Can they get married on condition that at some point, if the condition's not fulfilled, they'll get divorced? What about the Lieberman clause, which Rabbi Shaul Lieberman in the conservative movement added into the Ketubah to deal with the issue of Agunot? These are all important issues, and it's a complex topic. And therefore, I'd like to try and deal with it stage by stage so that we all understand it well. And therefore, today I want to, if you like, begin with the challenge. If you have a sheet, please look. If you don't, it's fine, because at the beginning you don't really need one. But let's start with a pasuk. There's some more coming. Let's start with a pasuk from this week's parsha. Okay? Number one. Ki yikach ish isha. When a man marries a woman, ubala, and they are together as husband and wife, v'haya, and it turns out in the future, im lo timtachein be'inav, if, here are the sheets. Excellent, Ricky, thank you very much. Please put your hand up. Baruch Hashem. So hand them around. There's maybe a couple over here. Thank you, Ricky, for copying them. I'll take one for the lady over here. Okay. Let's see if we can refocus. Is that a spare one? Okay. Very nice. Thank you, everybody, for being cooperative. So he says, "Im loitim tachein beinav, if the marriage doesn't work out," and here it expresses it in the sense that he no longer likes her, although we'll see what that means. Kimatza ba'erva davar, and there is some inappropriate behavior going on, and we'll see what kind of behavior that's talking about. The katav la sefer kritut, he has a mitzvah to write for her a piece of a sefer. A sefer doesn't mean a whole book, okay? A sefer can just mean one, if you like, one document. A document of separation, of severance. The natan v'yada, he has to put it into her hand, or give it to her. The shilchami beita, and then she will depart from his home, and then they are divorced. Meaning the Pasuk here gives a clear procedure as to how divorce works. It's interesting because it assumes that you know already how marriage works. That's one of the interesting things in the Torah Shabbat Tav. It tells you in detail how to get divorced, but it never tells you in detail how to get married. But over the years we've worked that one out, and we have a Torah Shabbat Tav which fills in the gaps as to how to get married. But clearly you see there is an obligation on the husband, just like the husband creates the marriage, obviously with the consent of the wife in the case of marriage, so too the husband has an obligation to support the marriage. We'll talk about that soon. And if the time comes that the marriage has to be ended, just as the husband had the obligation to start the marriage, to support the marriage, he has the obligation, where necessary, to end the marriage. And that is a mitzvah on his part. It's very clear that if the husband refuses to comply with this obligation where it's necessary, where the marriage has to end, and he refuses to give a get, that clearly is an avela. There are many isurim that the husband will be doing if he refuses to give a get where a get is needed. And I've just written down 8 or 9 Torah mitzvahs which the husband is in breach of if he refuses to fulfill this obligation. We talked about many of these in our series on Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. The mitzvah to love every other person, specifically starting with his wife. Not to retain hatred or rejection in his mind of another person. Not to stand by while others are suffering and he's causing this suffering, standing by watching this person suffer. Not to bear a grudge, not to take revenge, which so often happens in these marriage situations. The mitzvah d'oraisa, to do the right thing, to do the honest thing, the ethical thing. The halachta b'drachav, to follow the ways of Hashem, to be rachum v'chanun, and not to be cruel and hard-hearted. And of course, chilul Hashem, in the sense that he brings the whole of the Torah system into disrepute when men are refusing to fulfill their obligations to give a get. There is no question, therefore, that where a man has an obligation to give a get and refuses, he's a rosha. It is a type of abusive behavior to use financial or emotional leverage in order to gain on this refusal. And indeed, some of the classic Meforshim and the Poskim, Rav Yosef Henkin, describe this almost as akin to murder, causing this public embarrassment to the person. So there's no doubt that the husband is a rosha in this situation. The question is, how can we deal with him? How can we encourage him, enforce him where necessary? How can we deal with the situation in a way that the get will actually be given? It's one thing to call him a rosha, it's another thing to actually make the get happen. And we need to talk about how that could work. At the same time, on the other side of the coin, not every single woman who has requested a divorce in halakha is called an aguna. That is not the case either. There is no such thing as divorce at will in halakha. If the wife comes to the husband and says, look, you know, we've been married many years, I don't want to be married to you anymore. I want to marry someone else, or I don't want to be married at all, which could happen and does happen. And the husband turns around and says, well, I don't want to do that. I want to work on the marriage. I want the marriage to work. I want to try and make it happen. She says, well, I don't. I want out. And he says, well, no, I don't want out. That does not in halakha make her an aguna, because he is refusing in the marriage, because under those circumstances, that's perhaps an extreme case the other way, there is no halakhic reason for the marriage right there and right then to be ended. And she will not be classified in that as an aguna. There will come a point in the breakdown of that marriage where she will become an aguna. We have to talk about when that is. But it is important to note that not every marital dispute leads to an aguna situation. And therefore, that's part of the problem. And people get, obviously, this is a very controversial issue, and people can push the statistics one way or the other. Some people are very much pro-husband in this debate, some are pro-wife in this debate, and it's not always clear where the central ground is, and we need to try and find that clarity if we can. Now, aguna is not a modern problem only. It is also a specific modern problem, but it was clearly an ancient problem in the classic sense, which was in number two. It says in the Mishnah in Kiddushin, Ha'isha koina et atzma b'shtei drachim. A woman can acquire back her own freedom from the marriage, meaning having made a marriage, the marriage can be ended in two ways. Beget, with this sefer kritut, this document of separation, or b'mitat habal, if the husband were to die. And the classic aguna, of course, in the past, was a scenario where it's not clear whether the husband has or has not died. That was the classic aguna. Back in the day, danger and disease were present everywhere. Communications were limited. There was very little bureaucracy. People couldn't keep track of everyone. Now, as you walk through the streets, there are hundreds of cameras on you everywhere. It's very hard, actually, to hide these days. But that clearly wasn't always the case. It was not at all difficult for a death to go unrecorded, or indeed for an unhappy husband to just disappear without trace and start a new life somewhere else. It was very hard to actually control that. Less commonly, there were scenarios where the husband might be incapacitated or of unsound mind and not able anymore to give a divorce. They were the classic aguna situations. And wherever possible, Chazal invoked a principle that they want to try and be lenient in order to release agunot. Turn over to page 2, please. The Gemara in Gittin discusses why we treat aguna differently to other things. So the Gemara says, Eid echad me'iman be'isurin. This is a principle in halacha, that when it comes to isurin, prohibited and permitted things, one aid is acceptable. We do this all the time in kashrut. If I walk into someone's house, and the wife in the house cooks me a meal and tells me this is all kosher, that's fine. Aid echad ne'eman beitzurin. I trust her. She's an aid. She's a witness. She says that it's kosher. That's all that you need. You don't need two aidim to tell you that the food is kosher. So the Gemara then says, Eimud amrinan echad ne'eman beitzurin. When do we say one aid is sufficient for isurin? It's kagon chaticha safek shel chaylev safek shel shumen. If I have a piece of meat, and it's not clear there's a safek, is this kosher meat? In this case, fat. Is it shuman, which is kosher fat? Is it chaylev, which is non-kosher fat? And one aid comes along and says, believe me, it's fine. Good. So that's fine. Aid echad ne'eman beisurin. Deloy itchazek isura. There's no presumption that there was ever a problem. I just don't know. Is it good? Is it bad? Aval hocha, but in a case, says the Gemara here, did chazek isura. In a case where there is a presumption that there is a prohibition, the eishet ish havidava sheva erva, because if we know that the woman was married, and we know she was an eishet ish, we know she was prohibited to be married to someone else, then ein dava sheva erva pachot mishnayim. Then normally speaking, one witness is not sufficient, because there is a presumption of an issue of a prohibition that we need to actually release. And therefore one witness will not be sufficient, and we have a principle, ein dava sheva erva, when there's an issue of erva, meaning she's married to someone else, we have to have two witnesses to release the marriage, just like we have two witnesses to make the marriage. So here it says, so why with Aguna do we not have two witnesses? For Rabbanon hu de'itzrich, since this was a rabbinic requirement to have two witnesses, hacher, in the case of Aguna, mishum iguna, ikilu barabbanon. The rabbis were lenient wherever they could be to release Agunas, and to go back to the one, and therefore you only need one witness in order to certify, if you like, the death of the husband, where normally you'd expect that there should be two. The Yerushalmi puts it in these strong terms, number four, kal hikilu alea. They were lenient on their shaloi tahei yoshevet aguna. Because to be sitting and tied as an aguna for her whole life, they were trying to be as lenient as they possibly could. In fact, the Bach says in number five, Kol mi shematir aguna achat bazman, if you are able in a timely manner to free an aguna, ki'ilu bana achat b'charuvot Yerushalayim ha'elyona. You have built a block in Yerushalayim shel mala. The Bach is very strong on this, and therefore matir agunos is something that Chazal took seriously, to the point that the Mishnah in Yevamos goes through all sorts of extreme cases where we will release an aguna. Number six. May see an LP bat call. We even allow a maguna. This is a classic aguna, where the husband disappeared. Is the husband alive or is the husband dead? We will allow this woman to remarry even on the back of a bat call. What's a bat call? A voice, a disembodied voice from somewhere. Look what the Mishnah says. Master, there was a case, says the Mishnah, Be'echad she'amad al rosh hahar. There was someone standing on the top of a hill, the Amar, and shouting out, Ish ploini, ben ploini, mimakum ploini, mate. They heard someone screaming from the top of the hills. Such and such a man from such and such a place is dead. Halchu, they ran up to see who was screaming. Veloi matsu shamadam, they couldn't find the guy. Nevertheless, hisiu et ishto. They allowed the wife to remarry on the basis of the voice that they heard screaming, even though they could never verify it. Even more so, shuv master, a rather strange master, says the Mishnah, for Talmon, it happened once in Talmon, be'echad she'amar, someone walked in and said, ani ish pleini, ben ish pleini, I am this man, the son of this man, okay, nashkani nachash, I was bitten by a snake, v'hare ani met, and I'm dead. I am the ghost of this man, and I died. V'halchu, and they found a body, v'lohi kiru, but they couldn't recognize it. Or maybe the man came as he was dying, and then they found the body, and they couldn't recognize, they couldn't identify the body because it was too late. Nevertheless, he see you at Isha. They let the wife remarry. Now, this of course is not without its risks, because of course if the wife does remarry, which we're encouraged to, we encourage her to, or not encourage her, but we allow her to remarry, if it turns out that the husband didn't die, then that's a very unfortunate, tragic situation. Because if the first husband turns up again, then the second marriage clearly is invalid. The first marriage is also no longer valid. She has to divorce the first husband. And any children that were born from the second marriage will be mamzerim. It's very hard to create a mamzer in halakha, But clearly one of the ways that it could be done is if a second marriage was contracted which was not actually valid. And this, of course, was a problem, a major problem throughout history, where men had disappeared in war situations or in the Holocaust, in the Shoah. There were many, many cases where Rabbonim were very concerned to try and be matir agunot, but on the other hand, there is a real danger. To the point that the Gemara in Shabbat says, and this was the practice even through to the Second World War. Number 7, the Amar Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmeni, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Kol hayotze lemilchama, in the Milchemet Bet David, any of the army of David HaMelech who went out to war, Kotev get kritut leishto, would give a get to his wife before he left. And this is the practice after David, and according to many, even back to the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, I brought you some footnotes there, that they would give a get to their wife, that if I am reported missing in action, and I do not return home within X months, then you are divorced, the mafreya, retroactively from this moment, and free to marry another man. And that divorce was given. And I even brought you an example, if you're interested, to look it up on the internet, of a get al tanai from the Second World War that was given in the American and US Army in that way. Although this is actually not the practice, to my knowledge, in the IDF today, in war scenarios, but this was the practice in many situations. And of course, yesterday, 2 days ago, was the 15th anniversary of the 9/11 tragedy, and there were many cases of agunot that came out of that 9/11 tragedy, where the husbands were known to be in the building, but then were never discovered afterwards in terms of identification of a body. And I brought you just a couple of lines from a piece that was written after 9/11 here. It says in number 8 here, in its quest to confirm the fate of the victims, the Beit Din had to determine whether or which modern means of identification would comply with Jewish evidentiary standards. What would satisfy the physical evidence requirement? DNA evidence? What about dental records? What about the recognition of clothes or limbs? The Beit Din also posed additional questions. In the event a determination required reliance on eyewitness testimony, what person could provide such a testimony? Would they ask one of the non-Jewish fire officers who was in the building, who saw someone and then didn't see them, etc.? In searching for answers, we studied the literature of prior tragedies, finding Jewish legal discussions of husbands who disappeared in the sinking of the Titanic, in the collapse of bridges in Rome, in avalanches in the Alps, in artillery bombardments of World War I, in the sinking of the Israeli submarine, the Dakar. We also looked at cases of Israeli soldiers who had disappeared during the Yom Kippur War, and of course at Aguna cases relating to the Holocaust. Over the page. After 9/11, in some cases, the only evidence for placing someone in the World Trade Center at the time of the attack was circumstantial. A phone call made or email sent from within an office, swipe cards indicating entry, but no exit, and so on. In certain cases, investigators identified remains through the modern technology of DNA analysis. After a rigorous analysis of Jewish legal precedents, the Beit Din determined that DNA evidence could be marshaled for identification purposes, certainly when coupled with other circumstantial evidence of an individual's death. In the few cases where investigators found no direct physical evidence, the Beit Din relied on a third standard of proof, placing a husband with certainty in a situation in which no one could realistically be expected to survive. People who were on the upper floors of the Twin Towers when the planes crashed, the evidence was that there was no one who could realistically to survive that. With time, the Beit Din of America found sufficient evidence to make a declaration of death in each of the cases before it. In making those determinations, the Beit Din released each aguna according to the principles of Jewish law and enabled the victims' loved ones to mourn for those lost and begin to rebuild their shattered lives. Ultimately, the halachic process provided a time-honored framework for honoring the dignity of those who had died whilst creating a sense of direction for the spouses who had loved them. And in that way, all of the agunot out of the Twin Towers tragedy were eventually released.
How much time did they take?
Well, this article was written 10 years after the and therefore it took years and years in many cases for this to be done, but they worked very hard. This is the classic aguna issue. But this is not really what we're talking about today. We're talking about the modern aguna problem, which are husbands who are alive and well, who are refusing to give their wife a get, and thereby causing that anguish within the family. One of my friends, actually, in parentheses, in his first posting as a junior rabbi in London, received the following visit on a Shabbos afternoon. A man gives his first Shabbos in the community. He was about 22 or 23. A man came to the community and came to the rabbi's house and said, "Rabbi, you don't know who I am, but my sister is one of your congregants, and I came to ask you a question on her behalf. Okay, what's the question? Well, my sister's husband just died. She says, oh, I'm very sorry. He says, no, please don't be sorry, because my sister's not sorry. This was a man who had been refusing to give her a get for years and years and years. And now he died, and the balloons are popping, as it were. And the question now, she feels now a little bit guilty, because does she or does she not have to sit shiver for the husband who had died, even though she wasn't the slightest bit sorry that he'd died? Really interesting question, and not one that you really want as a junior rabbi on your first Shabbat in town. He told him to come back later, and he'd give him an answer. Indeed, he came back later, and actually this junior rabbi, who is now a senior rabbi many years later, told him that actually, in his opinion, the wife did not need to sit shiva for the husband, even though he was clearly the husband when he died. Anyway, this filtered back up to the authorities who'd employed this rabbi, the rabbinical authorities, who then called him in for a meeting and said, how is it that the first week we put you in this job, you told the wife she never needed to sit shiva for her husband? And he went through the whole case with them, and indeed they actually agreed with him in the end that since the shiva would be a kavod, it meant to be kavod to the mate, there wouldn't be very much kavod in her sitting shiva in this particular case. So this is a situation which clearly is people who are masarve gittin, who refuse to give their wife a get, clearly is the modern agunah problem. Now, despite the apparent unilateral nature of divorce, where it says in the pasuk, he has to give her a divorce, nevertheless, Chazal gave many situations where even if he doesn't want to give her a divorce, we tell him he has to give her a divorce. Okay? It's not just up to him. And we'll look at those situations in a few minutes. Additionally, Rabbeinu Gershom, in the 10th century already, changed the nature of the relationship between the husband and wife when he came to divorce, and said that if he gives her a divorce, she has to consent to a divorce, which is not in the original psukim. So one of the cherems of Rabbeinu Gershom is that no longer can a woman ever be divorced without agreeing to be divorced. Now, in doing so, the relationship between the husband and wife was, to some degree, equalized from what it had originally been. Not totally equalized, but to some degree. And this is a point which is worth making, because if you look in the Rosh in number 9, the Rosh, when he sums up what Rabbeinu Gershom was trying to do, he gives us a very important pointer. Elisha Rabbeinu Gershom, the Rosh lived just a couple of hundred years after Rabbeinu Gershom. The Rosh was in the 12th, 13th century in Europe. Elisha Rabbeinu Gershom ata gedel adavar. Rabbeinu Gershom, he said, has made certain key, drawn some lines and made some fences. Kira hador parutz, because he saw in his generation the people were parutz. Parutz here meaning they weren't respectful of the halachic system, they were breaking through. Umazalzalim b'benot Yisrael. And they were treating Jewish women inappropriately. Okay? And they were abusing the halachic system in order to do so. The zrikat get, they were throwing get in this case, at people. This was not husbands refusing to divorce their wives, it was the opposite problem. They were not taking their wives' feelings into consideration. But tiken. And therefore, says the Rosh, Rabbeinu Gershom made a decree to do what? Lahashvot koach ha'isha lekoach ha'ish. To try, and as far as halakhically possible, to equalize the power of the husband with the power of the wife. Okay? Kamosha ha'ish eino motzei ela ratzonot. So now, just like a husband may only divorce willingly with his own will, kach ha'isha eina mitgareshet ela ratzonah. Now a woman may only be divorced with her consent. What's interesting about this Rosh is not that it solves the modern aguna problem, but it tells you the direction that the rabbis were trying to go in, not to allow people to abuse the halachic system in order to have their own power relationship with other people. The Torah expects that the people who are listening to the Torah want to keep the Torah. It's often the rabbis that have to deal with the reality that not everyone's as big a tzaddik as the Torah would like them to be, and therefore the rabbis, if you like, it's the same with the ketubah. The Torah delineates what the obligations of the husband are during the marriage, and that should be all there is. Meaning if there's a husband who's not treating his wife properly, she should be able to tell the husband, look, the Torah gives you mitzvahs to support me. But somehow or other, not every husband responds to when she throws a chumash at him or shows a chumash to him. If they have a document, said the rabbi, it's called a ksubah, and she can wave a document in his face and say, look, you signed on the bottom line, then that helps. Why should that help? Why should that be more than a chumash? If the chumash tells him to do this, why should his... The answer is, it does.
It's
psychology. Right. The husband will respond more to something he signed. So too, the rabbis try to make sure that this works. Now, of course, this means that there is now a possibility that there could be husbands who are chained in a marriage where the wife refuses to accept a guest. And there are indeed cases like that. This is not the same, though, because the vast majority of cases where one spouse is being, if you like, abused by the other in this way, is the wife who is not receiving the get from the husband. There are cases where the husband is unable to divorce the wife, but they are very, very much the minority, and there are some other potential avenues to help the husband in that case. There is something called the Heter Meir Rabbanim, which is a complicated subject, which I'm not getting into now. I brought you a footnote. But there, since if in theory the husband would be entitled to marry a second wife, according to Torah law, so if the wife is unwilling to accept the divorce, there may be scenarios in which he will be allowed to get this Hetame Rabbanim, to get 100 rabbis to sign on a document to say he can go and marry someone else, although he's still married to the first wife. However, this is a very difficult thing to achieve. Whether it's open to abuse or not is a whole discussion as to how you get these 100 rabbis to sign, under what circumstances. It's certainly not intended to give some kind of an out to a husband who himself is refusing to give a get or treating the wife badly. And therefore, the Heter Meir Rabbanim is a limited solution, and it's not a solution for the wife, because she, by Torah law, cannot marry more than one husband. So even if she gets 1,000 rabbis to sign, it won't help, and therefore the Heter Meir Rabbanim is definitely not the answer here. Now, so what have we done to try and get the husband to comply with his obligations? So really the nub of the problem is over on page 4, which is, in order to give the get, it must be given willingly. How do we know that? Look at number 10. Asaradvarim, says the Rambam, Asaradvarim heim ikah hagerushin. There are 10 critical issues that are the heart of the divorce. Min ha-Torah, on a Torah level. The Elu heim, and these are there. And he goes through and he lists them. And one of them on the list is, Shelo yigaresh ha-ish ela ritzono. He has to give the get willingly. Uminayim, we'll see where that comes from. Uminayim she'asaradvarim elu min ha-Torah. Where do we learn all these things out from the Torah? And he quotes the pasuk in this week's Parsha Shneimar, V'haya im lo yisim tachem be'einav, V'katav la sefer kritut, V'natan be'yada v'shilcha mi'beito. He puts it, he gives it to her, natan be'yada. And the Rashbam in number 11 says, that's where we learn it from. V'natan mida'ato mashma. He gives it, he has to give it willingly. And therefore the Mishnah says in number 12, Ha'ish, Eino motzi ela liritzono. He can only give if he gives it willingly. What is the get called if it's forced? So number 13, the Mishnah in Gittin says, get me'useh, a get which has been forced, is one which is not valid. How does that work? B'Yisrael, he says, if the Jewish authorities forced him to give the get, kasher, that's okay. We'll see what this means in a minute. U'bagoyim, but if the non-Jewish authorities forced him to give the get, pasul, that is invalid. Ubagoyim, but the non-Jewish courts, choftim oto, can enforce on him, v'omrim, and say to him, l'omrim lo, asei ma she'Yisrael omrim lecha, do what the Jewish court told you to do, v'kasher, and then it's okay. So what you have is an interesting situation. If the Jewish court force him to give a get, that's okay. We'll see why in a minute. If the non-Jewish court force him to give a get, that's not okay. But if the Jewish court said to give a get, but they've got no power to force it, and the non-Jewish authorities step in, if you like, to say, do what the Beit Din told you, then that's already okay. Now, where does that leave us? How does that help us? Yes.
When you said Jewish court.
Yes, Beit Din.
You mean Beit Din, or you mean also a Jewish court?
No, the Beit Din. A kosher Beit Din, comprised, if you like, of Dayanim with proper qualifications. So how does this work, and what does it mean that the Jewish court can force him to give a get, and that's okay? By the way, the Rambam in number 14 clearly says that if the Jewish court forced him incorrectly to give a get, then it doesn't work. So it's not so simple just to say the Beit Din forced him, because if the Beit Din were wrong, then the get is invalid, and if the get is invalid and she remarries, then you're into another mamza nightmare situation. So we have to provide a solution which will actually solve the problem and not make the problem worse. What does it mean that the Beis Din can force him to give the get, and on a certain level that still calls him giving the get willingly? So here you have a fascinating situation. Look at number 15. Let's bring a parallel from Korbanot. The very beginning of Vayikra says the following. Im ola korbano min abakar, if he wants to bring an ola, as his korban, this has got nothing to do with divorce, he's talking about bringing a korban ola. If he brings an ola, min abakar, he has to bring it from the cattle, zakhar, a male animal, tamim, without any blemish. Yakrivenu, he has to bring it up as a korban, el pesach oel maed, to the gate, to the oel maed there, yakriv oto, there he has to bring it, liritzono, willingly, lifnei Hashem. He has to bring it willingly. Says the Gemara in Eruchin in number 16, Chayavei oilos v'shlamim. People who have to bring korbanot, mamashkinim otam. We can take a pikadon from them. We can take a collateral from them if they don't do it. Meaning this man, or woman for that matter, who is required to bring a korban, who is required to bring it willingly, nevertheless, if for whatever reason they are negligent and refuse to bring their korban, the Beis Din can enforce that. They can fine them. They can take money from them, saying, you've got to bring this korban, you better get on with it. Afalpi, says the Gemara here, even though she'ein mitkapelo ad she'yitratzeh, even though the kapora only works until he brings it willingly, why can he be forced to bring it? She'ne'emal, lirtzono. It says willingly, but kaisin oita, we can force him, ad she'yoma, until he says, roitze ani. You twisted my arm. Okay? We can force him until he says, I want to do it. That's okay with the korban. And then it adds at the end here, v'chein ata oime begitei nashim. The same is true when it comes to divorce from the husband with the wife. Kaifin oita, we can force him, ad she'yoma, until he says, roitze ani. What does that mean, we can force him until he says, roitze ani? This is not at all straightforward. Go over the page. There's the Rambam, very famous Rambam. Misha hadin noisen shekoifin oto. When the halacha requires us to force him, and we'll see not every husband can be forced to give a get, but in those scenarios, and we'll deal with them in a few minutes, who is obligated to give a get, who can be forced, when it says that the husband can be forced, legareshi ishtos, to divorce his wife, the loy rats to legareshi, and he refuses, beit din shal Yisrael, a Jewish kosher beit din, not the non-Jewish courts, v'chol makom, wherever they are, not just the Sanhedrin, or v'chol zman, not just in the time of the Mikdash, makinoto, they can even beat him, says the Rambam, ad sheyoma roitze ani, until he says, okay, I agree, v'yichtov get, and he'll have to get written. V'hu get kosher, and that's fine. V'chein, im haku goyim, similarly, if the haku goyim, if the non-Jews beat him, v'amru loyim, they said to him, asei mashi Yisrael omrim lecha, do what the Beis Din told you to do, the lachtus, and they press him, Yisrael, the yad hagoyim, okay, and they, at the hands of the non-Jews, they enforce the Beis Din judgment, ad shigaresh, until he divorces, harizek kasha, that's also good, because the non-Jewish courts are just being, if you like, the police force there. The im hagoyim atzmam anshur, but if the non-Jews of their own right force him, if there's some kind of a legal, secular legal obligation, they force him to give a get, ad shikatov, hoil v'hadin noisen sheikhtov, harizek get posel. That's not good. That's an invalid get. The lama ze lo batel get ze. Why do we not invalidate the get of the Beis Din that forced him? Sheharihu amel. Surely he's been forced by the Beis Din. Bein biyad goyim, bein biyad Yisrael. Whether the Beis Din physically forced him or they got the non-Jews to enforce it. If the Beis Din decrees it, why is that called willingly? She'ein omrim anus. He says amazing thing. We don't say someone was forced. Ela lemisha nechlat. Only if someone was forced to do something which he's not already obligated to do. Someone who beats someone up until they sell in their field. And they coerce him to beat the field, like Naval, etc., the case with Yezebel, etc. So he says, that's if he's not forced to do it. Aval mi. Shetakhu Yitzra Hara, someone whose Yitzra Hara has got the better of them, Levatel Mitzvah, and they're refusing to do a Mitzvah, or La'asot Aveira, or they want to do an Aveira, V'huka, and the Beis Din beat him, Ad She'asa Dava She'chayv La'asotot, until he does what he's really obligated to do, or Ad She'nisrachek V'dava Ha'isa La'asotot, and they will, or till he stops doing the Aveira, Ein Ze'anus, that is not called being forced Mimenu, Elohu Anas Atzmo, he forced himself. He overrode his own better instincts, if you like, b'da'at ha'ra. לפיכך זה שאינו רוצה לגרש מהאח שהוא רוצה להיות מישראל, רוצה הוא לעשות כל המצוות. We take his husband who refuses to give his wife a get when he's obligated to do so, and we say no, he really does want to give his wife a get because he's a Jew and a Jew wants to do mitzvot. Well, he'drachek min aveirot and he wants to avoid aveirot. The yitzro hu shetak for, and it is yetzer hara that's got the better of him. The kevan shehuka shetachas yitzro, and we've managed to release him from his yetzer hara. So I'm a roitzani, and he says, okay, kvar garash l'ritzon. Interesting. Okay. Now, as I said to you before, this is available to us only where the husband is obligated to give his wife a divorce, where the halacha says that we can force him to give his wife a divorce, then the Beis Din can step in and even take extreme measures. And we'll talk practically about what that means, especially in America and England, that doesn't mean very much because the Beis Din has very little power in the secular system. But in Israel, that means quite a lot, meaning there's all sorts of things that the Beis Din in this country can do in order to enforce and force a husband to give a get. But again, only when he's obligated and the Beis Din can halachically force it. When does that apply? When does that apply? So have a look in number 8, please. 18, sorry. Excuse me. 18. So it says as follows. Second. I'll just check if my recording is working. Yes. Nase ha'ish mukashchin. Says the Rambam. If, and he's getting this from the Mishnah, if the husband becomes afflicted, nevach, with leprosy, or something like that, a terribly debilitating disease, koitim oisav, then we force him in this situation, lahoiti, to divorce his wife, vilitank tuba. Nevach, it's a sad situation, but we say in this situation that the woman cannot possibly be expected to be in a marriage to a husband who is in this situation. This is an example of where we say to the husband, we will force you to give a get. Similarly, in number 19, im noilad l'rea chapeh, if during the marriage he develops excruciatingly bad breath, or rea chachotem, or he's just incredibly unpleasant smell around him, or shechazel alaket soat klavim, or he takes up a job collecting soat klavim, which I don't think is very pleasant, okay? Or he becomes some kind of copper miner, which apparently also is very unpleasant. Or he becomes a tanner, which has the most awful stink to it. And the wife turns around and says, this is certainly not what I had in mind when we got married. Again, the halacha says, we obligate him and to give the ksuba. What business of you being married? Have you got business married to a woman deciding to take on a disgusting profession of this nature? Even if nevach, it's not always the husband's fault if he develops this awful, awful bad breath and she can't be around him. But if she wants, tashavibala, she can stay with the husband. We don't force her to get divorced. If she says, no, it's fine. I'll put up with it. I'll buy some air fresheners. It'll be okay. Okay, whatever it is. And we don't force her to get divorced. But if she turns around and says, Taka, you're right, my husband has become working with Soat Klavim, I can't take this anymore. That's the classic case where the Beis Din said, Kofim. We can really force the husband, and the Rambam comes in there. However, says the Rambam, that's only very limited. Number 20, Ha'ish Shenodala Mumim Acher. Let's say the husband develops other infirmities or disabilities of different kinds. Okay, after he got married, not before he got married, after he got married, things change. Afilu nikta alayado, he loses a limb, or raglo, he uses a hand, loses a leg, or he's blinded, in one of his eyes. The law rat and ishtuli ashevimo, and the wife turns around and says, no, that's not what I had in mind, I didn't want to be married to a husband in this situation, I want a divorce. Ein kofim otolahotzi, we do not force him to give a get. Filiting ksuba and to give ksuba. Ale im rasa teshev, if she wants to live with him, she can. The im lo rasa teshev lo ksuba. She can leave, but he loses her ksuba. Kidin? To kidin call eshet isha moredet. Meaning, it's not so straightforward. Just because the wife turns around and says, after they've been married for years, this is insufferable, I cannot take this situation, this is not what I have in mind, my husband is now very different to what he used to be, that doesn't automatically mean that we say kofim. There may be a situation which is extreme, like the case of the mukashchin, or like the tzoat klavim, where we say, you're right, in these extreme scenarios we'll say kofim, But there are many, many scenarios where the husband may change, the wife may say, this is certainly not what I had in mind, and we do not say that this entitles you to get to the point that we will force the husband. She may be able to get a divorce if he's willing, but she may lose the ketubah, and says the Rambam, she may be classed as an isha moredet. Meaning what? Meaning she has decided, unilaterally to some degree, that she can't take this marriage anymore. Okay, maybe that's a scenario which we will encourage a divorce, because it's, the marriage is not going anywhere, but we can't force a divorce, because that's not one of the situations which will enable us to do so. And therefore, Tosfos came in number 21 and said, we have to be very careful about this. Because why? Mihu ein lachof shum adam legaresh. We cannot force just anybody to divorce. V'la'asot ma'aseh ad she'nimtza ra'ya brura, until we get clear proof that it's a case which deserves that. Dehamrina, because we say, a get mu'usah b'Yisrael shaloikidin, because even if the Beis Din force again, even if it's the Beis Din, but it's shaloikidin, but it's not halachically appropriate, pasul, then the get will be pasul. Ve'eila hatir eishet ish misafek. We can't just allow any wife to leave the marriage in a case which is a safek and force the husband to give a get. Which leaves us with a difficult cheshbon. There are extreme cases, let's just sum up, where the halacha says koifin, we force him to give a get. There, the Beis Din can step in, they can enforce it, they can even take radical measures to force him to give a get, and the get is kosher. But there are other situations where the halacha doesn't say koifin. It might say, for example, yotzi v'yitin ktubah. He should divorce her. But not that he has to divorce her. What if he becomes an apostate? What if he refuses to be religious anymore? And says, I don't want to be from, I want to become even a Christian, or something that, or that nature, the extreme situation. That's not one of the classic cases where the Beis Din says, we can force him to give a get. And what happens if he just recklessly squanders his money? And he just spends it all. He puts the whole house on red at the casino, which clearly is totally inappropriate behavior on every level. That's not one of the situations in which they say they can coerce him, they can force him to give a get. And therefore, it becomes very difficult in those situations to work out whether we can or whether we can't. What about in a situation where the wife just says subjectively, okay, I don't care what you think of the situation, I can't live with him anymore. I'm the one that has to live with him. You may turn around and say, well, this is not objective, yeah? But I'm the one who's here on a daily basis. I want to leave the marriage. What do we do in this situation? And she's absolutely insistent on it. So this is a big machlokas, and this will take us into the, if you like, the Shulchan Aruch in about 2 or 3 minutes. There is a very big debate on this, meaning in a case where the halacha says koifim, okay, we force him. In a situation where it says he should divorce, there's a big debate. In a situation where the wife just says, I want out, the husband cannot be, I can't live with him anymore, what do we do? So the Rambam comes in number 22 and says an interesting thing. Look at number 22. Ha'isha Shemana'a ba'ala mitashmish. A wife who refuses to be with her husband, to have a marital relation with her husband, she refuses mitashmish amita. He nikreit moredet. She's called a moredet. She's refused. It's not a situation where he's refused. She says, I want out. I don't want to be with you anymore. V'sho'elinota. We ask her, mitneima marda. Why did she do this? What are the situations? Says the Rambam, im amra, if she says, ma'astiyu, he disgusts me. Okay? Ve'eini yukhola lihiba'ello. I cannot be with him anymore. It's just offensive to me to be with him. Okay? Midati, willingly, I cannot do this. So the Rambam says a very radical thing. Kaifin oisolahoti. He says that too will entitle us to force him to divorce her if she's so strong about it. Lashata. Lefi why? She'enu kishvuya. Because no wife is a shvuya. No wife is a captive, okay? Shitba'el l'sanuila, that she should be forced to have an intimate relationship with someone that she hates. V'kese, and she can leave the marriage. B'loi k'tuba klal, but she doesn't get her k'tuba, because she's the one that wants out. But says the Rambam, even that scenario is one which we will allow the Beis Din to force him if she's so adamant that she can't live with him anymore. That was the Rambam's position. But you should know many of the Rishonim were very, very unhappy with that Rambam. Very unhappy indeed. Look at the Rosh, number 23. Uma netina tam lakop ha'ish legares u lahatir eshidish. What reason has been given here for us to force the husband to divorce the wife and be matter and eshes ish? Lo tibal lo. She doesn't want to be with him, so let her not be with him. V'tutzra'al manot chayot. If she decides that she doesn't want to be married to him, no one's forcing her to have a relationship with him. Meaning, in halacha, it's absolutely prohibited under all circumstances for the husband to force the wife into a physical relationship. So she'll separate, they'll live separate lives. V'halo einu mitzuvah peri arivia. She has no halachic obligation to have children. If she wants to live on separate floors in the home, that's up to her. That does not give us an obligation to force him to divorce. Because she has decided subjectively. Maybe she's decided she prefers to be married to another man. You don't know. That happens too. And she prefers the other man to the husband of her youth. Are we going to encourage that and allow that? And we're going to force the man. Maybe he still loves her. Are we going to force him to divorce her? He's very unhappy about it. And this was a very fraught debate within the Rishonim. Again, where the wife turns around, there is no objective ground to force a divorce, but the wife turns around and says, that's it, I can't stand him anymore. The Rambam said, okay, so we will enforce the divorce, you just lose your ketubah. The Rosh said, no way, we will not enforce a divorce in those situations. That's not called an aguna, because you've decided you want out, because you'd find the husband repulsive. In and of itself, that's not called an aguna. Now, it may lead to a situation where the marriage breaks down to the point where both sides now turn around and say, this marriage is effectively over, and then we will be in a scenario of an aguna. Okay? But right at the beginning, it's not so easy to do. So what can we do? If we can't force him, what can we do? So this is where I want to come to 24, which is where the halacha sets out different options that may be available, even if we can't force him to give a divorce. Have a look at number 24. Says the Shulchan Aruch, Kol Eilu, in all cases, she'amru lahoitzi, where the halacha has said that we have to cause him to give the divorce, kaifim, we force him, afilu b'shotim, even if it requires physical sanctions. That, he says, in principle allowed. We'll see that today very limited. The yesh omrim, and there is an opinion, shekol mi shaloi nema boi b'gemara b'feirush kaifim lahoitzi, that if it doesn't say in the Gemara explicitly that we force him to divorce, Ella, but rather it just says, Yotzi Bilvad, he should divorce, that's not the same. Then Ein Kofim B'Shotim. Then we cannot enforce that physically. Ella Omrim Lo, but we say to the husband, look, Chachamim Chiyuvcha Lahoitzi, the rabbis have told you, you should give your wife a divorce. You don't have to, but you should. Or maybe you have to, but we can't force you. And then, if he won't give the divorce, we can't force it physically, but we can call you a sinner. A Rosha, like I said before. What does that mean? That means there are different communal sanctions that can then kick in. And here the Ramah fleshes this out. In the Rashi script. Since there is a big debate, we saw the Rambam versus the Rosh, etc., on where exactly we can force a divorce, you can't physically force the divorce where it's not clearly the case that that's mutter, because otherwise the divorce is invalid and the next marriage will be invalid as well. We don't want to risk a get ma'useh. That causes a problem bigger than it solves. If another case we haven't dealt with, a man married a woman he should never have married in the first place. A Kohen who married a divorcee, let's say. That there, everyone agrees we can enforce the divorce. Now, if we can't physically enforce the divorce, what can we do? So what's one option? Cherem is one option. So the Ramah says, not so fast. Ein menadin oisagam came. He doesn't feel that cherem is always appropriate. Cherem is an interesting solution. We'll talk about that in a minute. Does that work? How does it work? Is it effective? Nevertheless, you're calling Ligzor al Kol Yisrael, but you can publicly make a decree on all other Jews that they are not allowed to have any social involvement with this man because he's refused the divorce. They can't do anything good to him. Or Lisa, Volis anymore, they can't do any business with him. Or Lamul Banav, they can't even be a moil for his son. Or La Kovra, and nobody can bury him. That's often quite an incentive. Okay. Okay? Meaning we can declare this man persona non grata, and nobody can have any involvement with him ad shigareish until he divorces his wife. Ubekol chumra shiritzo based in, and any kind of stringency that the based in wants to apply here, yucholim lahachme b'kai govna, they can enforce in this way. Umavad shelo yinadu osa, he says, I don't think you can put him in cheirim. Avam misha einu mekayim ona, but there are cases even then yucholim lahachme, you can't put him in cheirim. So where does that leave us? Realistically, it means that there are scenarios where we can mamash force the husband, but there are scenarios where we can't force him, but we can apply certain sanctions. And just turn over to the last page, number 7, and we'll see what they are, and we'll wrap this up there, and then we'll talk next week about other options. So up until now, what halachic options do we have to require a husband to give a divorce? So we said physical violence. Under certain circumstances, theoretically, then that could be justified where it's obligated and we say kaifim, but reality is that in many jurisdictions, if not most, it will be impossible and criminally illegal to do that. And clearly where the law of the land does not allow us to apply any kind of physical sanction, that will not be possible or in any way appropriate. And there have been many scenarios, cases in America. In fact, there was a whole sting operation a few years ago where the police were trying to get onto people who were beating up husbands, and of course they found them, and there are people in jail for that. And one thing is for sure, by the way, if the family members decide to beat up the husband in order to get him to give the wife a divorce, that for sure won't achieve anything other than just beating up the husband. The divorce will not be a valid divorce. It has to be the Beis Din, but practically speaking, the Beis Din in almost every country is certainly not able to do that, and some might argue should never be able to do that. So physical violence, let's say, is definitely out. What about cheirem? So there are scenarios where cheirem is justifiable, where the husband can be forced to give a divorce. There are cases where the remorse says it's not justifiable. The question is it effective? Cheirem works well when people have their own small social circle, and if you fall outside that, then that's it, you can't function. Today, in the very global, joined-up world that we live in, a cheirem is only as effective as the communities who wish to enforce it. And unfortunately, so many times, this community declares a cheirem, so the man just moves 50 miles down the road and goes live somewhere else, make a nice donation to the community there, and they'll happily integrate him there. You have to question whether cheirem really works and how it works. In small communities, which are very tightly run, it can be very effective. There are communities in the world which are so tightly run that no one can buy or sell a home in that community for a price unless the Rav agrees on the price that they're asking for the home. Everything is very tightly controlled. Okay? Gateshead is a community very like that, where it works very effectively in the old-fashioned way. So maybe there the cheirem really means something big. But in most metropolitan cities, it's harder to do that. There are what the Rama was describing, which are called harchakos de Rabbeinu Tam, the distancing the husband. I put here they can be prohibited from speaking to him, doing business with him, hosting him, giving him food and drink, visiting him when they're sick. They can withhold honors in shul. As I said, not burying him, performing milah on his son. What's that? Cheirem is a whole different thing. Cheirem is a person that has been declared a non-person entirely in terms of the community. They're not even like Spinoza was put in cheirem. That's it. You're part of the community, but we're just going to put sanctions on you to try and incentivize you in order to do things. Cheirem is more intense than that, although in reality, often it's the same thing. In Israel, there are more options. I put here, for example, the Rabbanut, which has a legal standing in this country, and there's a joined-up system, which is irritating sometimes because it's bureaucracy, like, when you don't have the right paperwork in order to get the Tu'udat Nisu'in, where the excitement of the wedding of my daughter, Baruch Hashem, is still with us, but so is all the bureaucracy now of working all the paperwork with this one and that one, etc. While sometimes this is a little bit irritating, when it comes to this scenario, it's actually very helpful, because the Beis Din can do all sorts of things. They can stop the husband from receiving a passport, which of course they can't do in England or America. They can stop him from leaving the country. They can stop him from getting a driving license or renewing a driving license, which could effectively ground the husband. They can stop him from getting money out of the cash machine. That can be quite a strong incentive. They may even put the guy in jail. Where there is an obligation, halacha, to force, which we said is not always the case, we can even get the guy put in jail. There have been cases where they've been denied mahadrin food in jail. I mean, you might take the view that they shouldn't get mahadrin food anyway if they're in jail, but that's a different debate. But the basin can say, no, you're not getting your mahadrin food until you comply. You never know. For some people, their pressure point can be all sorts of things. And also, if the husband is up for good, for early release for good behavior, the basin can nix that and say, no, you're spending your whole time in jail, if he's in jail for something else, let's say, because you won't give your wife a get. So that clearly, in Israel, gives us that. But again, not in all scenarios. Not if the wife just turns around and says, I want a divorce. It won't necessarily allow that until the marriage really breaks down. Social pressure, obviously, is very significant and can be very effective. Back in the day when people used to, you know, write things in newspapers, now it's a lot on social media. They have demonstrations. There have been many communal rabbis which have got this community together to demonstrate outside people's homes, outside people's workplaces. There are organizations in America that very much do this, that help wives to pressure the husbands who are not giving the gittin, pressures on bosses to fire workers who are withholding a get, okay? These things are all possible. But they don't solve all the problems. That is absolutely clear. And therefore, there have been many attempts over the last 150 years, which we will look at, Be'ezrat Hashem, next week, to nix the problem before it begins. To do something at the beginning of the marriage in order to avoid the possibility that this will even get to this kind of discussion of coercion, of social sanction, etc. And therefore, next week, what I'd like to do is I'd like to really examine 8 or 9 of those different methods, see what people say about them, why some people think they are good, some people think they don't work, and ending up with a detailed discussion of the prenuptial agreement, which a lot of people feel is one of the most effective solutions that we've come up with. Yes? Not in where, obviously, so actually applied in whatever way we want it to apply. But the classic scenario of this Shulchan Aruch is in the husband, not the wife. Okay, we'll leave it there for now. I wish you a wonderful week, and we'll pick it up next week, please, God.